Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. Being able to see and accept that others may have a worldview fundamentally different from your own was once considered a benchmark of psychological maturity, which is evidently lacking in contemporary foreign affairs. With the Western earlier assumption that economic development would do away with geopolitical differences now proven wrong, is a clash of great powers inevitable? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Yu Bin, Senior Fellow at the Russian Studies Center at the East China Normal University and Senior Fellow of the Shanghai Association of American Studies. Dr. Yu, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me here.
Now, let me start with an issue that is very close to my heart and my home. This is a conflict in Ukraine. And you've argued in your articles that these Western fears of the Russian-Chinese alliance are greatly exaggerated, that Beijing is taking a distinctly neutral position. But do you think the Chinese and the Americans define neutrality in similar terms?
No. I think the West sees as sort of like alliance making. At least, you know, it's elements over there. But it has been my opinion that the Sino-Russian strategic relationship is by and large a normal relationship. It is normal because it is the result of the two extreme relationship that the China's, the then Soviet Union, Russia has gone through. From the honeymoon allies of the 1950s to the enemies of 30 years during the much of the Cold War. So Russia and China have gone through that two extreme ends, and the normalization in 1989 was a turning point. The two large countries turned to a normal relationship in which both are independent large powers and actually independent civilizations.
What I like about your framing of an argument is that you clearly show that this kind of framework allows for genuine cooperation, for finding areas of mutual benefit, but also leaves space for genuine disagreements. And for example, in the case of Ukraine, China understands Russia's security sensibilities, but it clearly is not approving of Russia's chosen form of action. And Russia is not asking for its approval. It's Russia's own responsibility, Russia's own decision. But again, I want to bring us back to the Americans, because they feature prominently in the Ukrainian conflict. And for them, it's either you are with us or you're against us. And I wonder if China's neutrality, the way it's seen in China and the way you describe it in your articles, would be inevitably perceived as defiance by the Americans.
Yes, the United States and the West, particularly the US policies, they do not accept anything in the middle. So as you frame it, it's a be with us or against us. This has been Western policy towards international politics, major power politics, ever since the end of the Cold War. If you recall back to 20 some years ago, actually, this is exact 20 years ago, when the United States started to invade or about to invade the Iraq on the pretext of weapons of mass destruction, which is a fake. The President Bush policy is to be with us or against it. But if the world still remember, or the West still remember, four large powers try to take a different approach. They were the French, the Germans, the Russians and the Chinese. They disagree with the US and the British policy, or the English-speaking country's policy, and they want to take a neutral stand. They were not convinced, but they were told to be with us or against us. So this is the continuation of I would say, the US policy. So, with regard to the current Chinese middling position, I would say it's not kind of like a pure neutrality. China does have its own view about right or wrong, or what contribute to this. But Chinese position is impartial. It's trying to see how much the conflict can be stopped, de-escalated, and the civilian casualty be avoided as much as possible, which is good for both parties. Of course, it's not just to stop fighting, but Chinese are looking for a long-lasting, stable, and continuous, security framework in Europe, which is good for Europe, for the world too.
But Dr. Yu, I'm sure you would agree with me that beyond this particular conflict between Russian military forces and Western-aided Ukrainian forces, there is a larger struggle going on, and it's a struggle for the future of the international system, for the future design of the international system, and whether it continues to be so unipolar with the United States calling all the shots, regardless of the possible consequences, or whether it's going to be more balanced or perhaps even more democratic. Would you say that in that bigger struggle, China is also neutral?
I would not use neutrality for that kind of... I think China, to a large extent, align with or agree with Russia, even before the Ukraine crisis, that the world needs to be more democratic, which is different from the democracy only for certain domestic system, in a way that there is a trend towards a more multipolar system, if people want to use it, or some people like Richard Haass of U.S. Council of Foreign Relations is a non-polarity world, but that is not necessarily agreed by some or many in the United States. I think the future world order is unclear. Actually, even before the launch of the Russian special military operation in Ukraine, there was a debate, which lasted for several years, about whether the so-called liberal international order is failing or has failed, and who caused it. So the Western academia and the policy circles had debated for several years about the decline of the West. I think the war in Ukraine actually was a major development towards something new, but we are in uncharted waters right now.
Before we go deeper in discussing historical and political matters, I want to ask you, and I'm not sure it's even a political question, because there has long been an assumption in the United States that, particularly about China, but not only about China, that if China develops, if it becomes stronger economically, it would be more like the United States. And what I think the Americans meant by that is that it would be subservient to the United States, that it would accept the American way of life, the American rules, the American so-called leadership, what have you. And China is not the only country that have gone through that. Look at Turkey, look at Russia, look at Brazil. There are many non-Western countries who have gone through some sort of westernization without changing their intrinsic political, social, and cultural nature. And I wonder, how do you explain to yourself and to your audience this American belief that simply because the countries will get richer, for some reason, they will change their national selfhood to be in the image of the Americans?
Well, this is a very profound question. I think there's a totally different take of the rise of China between the West in general and the U.S. in particular. I think there's a growing trend in the United States to see China's rise as a threat. But the China threat has never gone. And ever since the end of the Cold War, people start to argue the rise of China. And curiously, there are two schools of thought. One is China collapse argument, that China, according to some, if not many, would collapse like the former Soviet Union because it's not a good system. The other argument, or the other extreme, is if China threat and constant, if China does not collapse, China must threaten others. So these are two extreme views of China, which has been going on for several decades. But the problem is, in the real world, there are seldom phenomena or things that black and white in nature. But the Western approach to anything internal, personal, interpersonal, or interstate relationship is one of black and white. But the reality is there are many, many shades of different colors, different shades. And the Chinese philosophy approach to the issue is, if we're different, we can work together. This is the Confucius notion that the unity of the differences or harmony of the differences. The Western approach is the unity of the sameness.
No, it's not just we are the same. You are like us. You abandon all your cultural, social, religious, economic heritage in order to be like us. And, one should ask, what is it so attractive about the American way of life? I mean, look at the obesity rates. Look at the suicide rates. Look at the rates of incarceration. I mean, the American society is not what it used to be. Why do we even have to aspire to be like them? I mean, it's not an appealing picture.
I think you pointed to another side of the debate. That is, what caused all those problems inside the West in general, like the rise of populism even before the Russian use of force this time, and the rise of Donald Trump or the far right extremist forces. And these are the things, to what extent it relates to the rise of China. You can blame lots of things on others, but there are limits how far you can solve your own problem. And I think one of the major problems is the liberal international order, which actually promotes the global capitalism or globalized capitalism to look for the market, cheap labor, and profitability, but ended up depriving Western or American, real jobs. So this is the capitalism in the working. So the real problem lies in how to redistribute the wealth that liberal capitalism actually received from this globalization. So the internal redistribution mechanism has a lot to do with the current problem in the United States.
You mentioned the capitalist system, which, it's almost an anathema in the West to criticize it, but it's so intrinsically unfair, and it's even, I mean, anyone who can look at pure figures, it's impossible to deny that it's in the current shape or form, it's highly detrimental to the Americans themselves. Now, I know you have an expertise in American studies. How do you explain to yourself that the Americans are not demanding more from their system, that they are eager to be fed this vitriol about Russia, about China, about Iran, about other nations, other axes of evil, but that they do not actually look and ask more from their own leaders?
Very brilliant question, and but thank you. My personal opinion is, I think China actually, and to a certain extent, Russia too. Both Russia and China became, or I view Soviet Union, became the friends of the West at the end of the Cold War, even before the end of the Soviet Union. The world actually, according to President Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, was a new international order already several years before the end of the Soviet Union, which is largely, I believe, the personal, some certain actions of the Soviet leaders. At the end of the Cold War, the liberal international order actually had occupied a very advantageous position. And both Russia and China actually tried to a certain degree, emulate, adopt certain aspects of Western. But what happened later was totally different. I mean, President Putin actually was, let me use the word, pro-West. And he tried to join NATO. China too tried to emulate, learn from the West. Maybe China become them two good students of the West and become such, I would say, a stable, successful model. So the rise of China caused tremendous psychological or real issues for the West to handle or to explain, because you cannot explain to the Westerners that the rise of China, which is un-Western, non-Western, even non-white, non-liberal, can be successful. So it must be, stealing things from us. Oh, so this okay. is the kind of a problem between, but it's a very asymmetrical perception between the United States and China. I think most of China.
Doctor, you are speaking about asymmetries. We have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back. I promise we will be back to this conversation in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Yu Bin, Senior Fellow at the Russian Studies Center at the East China Normal University and Senior Fellow at the Shanghai Association of American Studies. Dr. Yu, just before I cut you off, before the break, you were talking about the fact that the necessity to make something dangerous out of China and perhaps to some extent out of Russia and other countries rises up from the fact that China has been able to, you know, diligently learn the American lesson and to apply it the best way it could to its own soil and lift millions of people out of poverty, which it continues to do, not only in China, but also in many other countries. One could argue that the United States could do the same thing. I mean, like, they're still the most powerful country in the world. And rather than trying to fight against history and sort of, you know, holding to this escaping unipolarity, they could, you know, use their advantageous position and, you know, go along with the flow. Why do you think they're trying to fight history rather than trying to harness it?
It's a big issue. I think the conception of history is very different in the United States. And there are lots of good scholars, strategists like George Kennan, Henry Kissinger, or even Mearsheimer of University of Chicago. They are good scholars. They see that it's a historical trend. I would say realist, and they treated the international politics very different from the current. So unfortunately, the realists are mostly marginalized. Let me give you one kind of like an example. Back to the Clinton times, I believe 1997, when NATO expansion started, George Kennan published article in the New York Times and saying that the West made a fatal mistake. The fatal mistake to, let me quote, to expanding NATO would be the most fateful error of American policy in the entire post-Cold War era. But George Kennan's view was ignored because I believe the Clinton administration believed enjoyed, you know, prosperity and unipolarity and practically dominance. So this is the kind of like a long-term view of the history was ignored. And also to get back to your question about the issue of history, I talked about at the end of the Cold War, both Russia and China were friends of the West and the United States. Even after the September 11th, who called President Bush first, immediately after the September attack? It was President Putin. And who was number two to call in to pledge support? It was Chinese President Jiang Zemin. So even at that point, when the United States started to refocus on major power politics, which was George Bush's strategy, his campaign rhetoric, but September 11 derailed that, but it was Russia, it was China trying to helped the United States. By the way,
but let's not skip that point, because I think it's actually a fundamental issue, because I think both Russia and China, and you've also written about it, these two countries have managed to develop a kind of relationship that doesn't confine each other, doesn't put, you know, strict preconditions on that relationship. You are either with me or you're against me. You know, China can have its own views on Russia's action in Ukraine. Russia can have its own views on China's actions wherever, but they can respect each other enough on a human and national level not to preach and not to give each other lectures. The United States is different. It sees no peer. I mean, no other country, you know, worthy of the same respect as the United States. And my question to you would be here. I know you believe in principle neutrality, but the Americans, having picked up the fight with Russia, I think are now picking up the fight with China as well. And the pressure on China accelerates, not only in terms of discussed sanctions, but also help, military help for Taiwan, what have you. You know, there are many provocations. Do you think that kind of principled neutrality would serve China well in the face of ever more, not just assertive, but ever more aggressive United States? Can you actually deter a bully by being principled in such a way?
These are two, from a Chinese perspective, the Ukraine conflict and the Taiwan issue are different issues. Ukraine is one of, at least between two, theoretically independent states, which means sovereignty issue. But the Taiwan issue has been regarded by not only the Chinese, but also the United States too, as an issue of China, one China issues. There's only one China, the US official policy, despite how much it's been scaled back these days. So the Chinese thinks that these are different, but the Chinese sees that the Taiwan issue become far more challenging. The conflict, the prospect for conflict is rising, and it's a very difficult issue. It's make even more difficult now to scale back, to step back. So I think the danger is rising, but I think looks like both sides still not, you know, the U.S. side tried to reinterpret Taiwan issue one way or another, but the question is how much China can maintain this neutrality, or let's use the word neutrality. I would say this is precisely the issue, that the rising tension from the United States to force China to choose sides. And precisely at this moment, Chinese believe it is time at the 1 year anniversary of the Ukraine conflict to promote peace, to propose the Chinese version of the peace solution. And of course, the Chinese have been talking about many of those points in the past year, multiple times. And this is a very comprehensive approach. And it's not just about the Ukraine conflict. It's about the European security system and about the world system. So it is time. And China is in an advantage position or different position or unique position, unlike those who directly or indirectly participated, and to find a different approach. Of course, the alternative is not to talk, not to have peace arrangement, and to continue to fight. What's the point? So the Chinese really want to reinforce this position of principled neutrality, regardless of Taiwan.
Dr. Yu, I understand that, and that has been centuries long Chinese position. You know, this contemplative distancing, the principle of non-action, Wu Wei, we all know about that and we appreciate it greatly. And I think in this world where, you know, rush action has caused many millions of deaths and refugees, this is a highly valuable and very balancing approach. Again, having said that, I know the Chinese believe that time is on your side, but are you sure that the Americans will allow you to avail of that time? Because the very same bill that authorized military aid for Ukraine, you know that, authorized military aid for Taiwan as well. And sure, you can. I know that there are legal differences between the two cases, but the main participant there is still the same. The United States that wants to cause trouble, and not in their own backyard, but rather either in your jurisdiction or on our borders. So again, my question is the same. Do you think the Americans will allow China to keep that position of distance neutrality?
My own point, you know, this is just my personal view, is I think certain institutions or individuals in terms of civil-military relations in the United States are driving the situation towards more conflictual or even a showdown with China, which is essentially try to squeeze the strategic space of China and Russia too. But the reason why the Chinese still push for the peace resolution is not just idealistic. It has practical purpose. Let me give you a couple of quick reasons. If you think Russia's relation with the West in Europe was currently is a conflict, but if you look at how Russia and China and settle their border problem, their security problem, at more or less the same time when NATO started to expand in the West, Russia's relations with the Eastern partners, including China or those Central Asian states, actually have been totally in different mode of confidence building, negotiations, dialogues, Shanghai, cooperation organization. These are the same issue of the post-Soviet space. How to handle it? There are two radically different examples. The Chinese peaceful, push for peace resolution actually has its own examples and involving Russia. So if you say Russia is the blame for everything, but Russia has settled this relation with China in the East. And this is something that the world seemed to ignore. And the Chinese Russians developed a framework, a mechanism for both sides to adjust their national interests on a pragmatic basis. So this is the example China wants to drive to. Of course, if the China's proposal is largely rejected or ignored by the United States, but it's not rejected by Ukraine, by Russia, and even the Europeans. So someone must start with this. Again, the alternative to talk is not to talk. And more people would die and a stagnant front line. This is very much like 1916. This is the term I coined the 1916 moment in a recent article. And I think this is a turning point. And China actually is not alone. Many other countries, I probably believe India would come up with something.
Absolutely. And Doctor, we have to leave it there because our time is up. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.